Welcome to Science Fiction 101, the podcast series which looks at science fiction from every which way, including, but not limited to, the past, the present, and the future. I'm Phil.
And I'm Colin.
We're recording in October 2023, and in today's show, we have our Hugo short story review special. More on that in a bit. But first, as usual, letters from listeners. Nobody's actually sent us a letter, Colin. I'm very disappointed. Maybe it's because we don't give out a mailing address.
These days, that seems like a dangerous thing to do for online people.
True, true. I've just got a few random responses on previous episodes here. Following our Doctor Who episodes, Andy wrote, "I love how Phil is showing Colin quintessential classic British sci-fi," which made me wonder if there are any very American sci-fi shows that didn't make it over here because they are too American, in quotes. Which is a very good question. And Joe responded to this saying, "There were a bunch of cheesy sci-fi shows in the US after Star Wars. Not sure what would have made it to Britain back then. Popular and somewhat popular ones like $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, Buck Rogers, Original Battlestar, and not successful ones like Automan, Manimal," you remember Manimal?
I do.
"Fantastic Journey, etc." Oh, that message took me back. Actually, Joe, we had all of those shows that you mentioned, and in my recollection, you have to go way cheesier to find ones that we didn't get in the UK. So we didn't get Land of the Lost. We didn't get Ark 2. We didn't get Jason of Star Command. So it's those things which are sort of Saturday morning children's entertainment. Those are the ones we didn't get. But all of those others that Joe mentioned, yeah, we had those. And that was my childhood. $6 Million Man, Bionic Woman, Fantastic Journey, yeah, loved all of those. And in response to our Desert Island Books episode, Seth was the first to leap in with his book picks. He said he would take, onto the mythical desert island, he would take Speaker for the Dead by Orson Scott Card, because it would inspire him to make friends of all the trees, he says. For an anthology or collection, he would take Selected Stories of Philip K. Dick. For his non-science fiction book, he would take Shogun by James Clavell, which he said was his dad's favourite and a very long book that he enjoys. And for his non-fiction pick, he would choose The Baseball 100 by Joe Poznanski, which he describes as 900 pages of baseball goodness. So there we go. I'm looking forward to the British version of that book, which of course will be called The Cricket 100.
Are you a cricket fan? Do you follow it like a sport?
No, no. Okay. I did when I was a kid, and I did play a little bit of cricket, and I was also a scorer. Cricket is so complicated. You have to have somebody with a special score sheet filling it in to keep a detailed record of the game. And that was something that I did when I was about 12. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can post a comment on our blog, which is at 101sf.blogspot.com. Or you can find us on Facebook as Science Fiction 101 Podcast. As we speak, it's just a few days before the 2023 Hugo Awards are announced at the World Science Fiction Convention, which is happening in Chengdu in China. So by the time you hear this podcast, the winners will be known, okay? So Colin and I are now going to make fools of ourselves by reviewing the stories before we know which one has won, and we'll probably predict the winner incorrectly. And so everyone can have a good laugh at us for being so wrong. But it's the discussion of the stories that matters, not who wins. But I will, if I remember, I will come back after the winner has been announced, and I will drop in a little bit saying who the winner was. So if you're listening to this, you will hear which one won, even though Colin and I don't know at the time of recording, if that makes sense.
I followed it.
Yeah, oh, good, good. I'm not sure that I did. So, Hugo Awards for short story. It's a very strange ballot this year because the convention is taking place in China, we've got a large number of stories that were written in Chinese. And
yeah,
I'm not aware of that sort of thing happening before.
Yeah, it makes me wonder whether or not, you know, our Worldcon is slightly misnamed. So for people that aren't familiar with the Hugos are an international award, and the people who select and vote on the Hugo winners for that year are the Worldcon conference attendees.
Yeah.
And since this year it's in China, like Phil has mentioned, Chinese science fiction is getting a lot of attention, which it should, because based on what I read, it's really pretty good.
Yeah.
I wish it was more conveniently available.
What I think is unusual here is, as I say, it's in China, so therefore there's a large number of Chinese people attending the convention, so they have voting and nominating privileges, absolutely mm-hmm. right, and therefore they've nominated fiction that they know. That's absolutely fine.
But yeah.
It does raise this issue of how representative of the field of science fiction can the awards ever be. And that's always been the case, but it's been kind of hidden from us by the fact that the convention has more often than not been held in an English-speaking country, mostly the US, occasionally the UK, and of course it has been in other countries as well. But it is predominantly an American convention, really. And I think this is the first time that I've looked at the nominees on the ballot and gone, oh, because I'm surprised at how kind of polarized the stories are on the ballot.
To try and learn a little bit more about the authors, I went to ISFDB.
Mm.
And several of these authors have links to their Chinese science fiction database. There's a csfdb.cn website.
Wow.
And our ISFDB, the International Science Fiction Database, is missing entries from the other one in China. So if you do the same thing that I do, be sure you go to the Chinese one and find the true history and the multiple names the authors used in the different Chinese ideograms, and they're sometimes well-translated English names, sometimes not.
Yeah.
You'll get the whole story over there.
Wow, that's amazing. I never thought to do that. I'll have a look at that. That's great. So the first one is Zhurong on Mars, which is by Regina Kanyu Wang. I'll try and summarize this story, although it's a bit difficult to do, I find. Essentially, the premise is that humankind has taken over the planet Mars, but then deserted it, leaving what is known as the Waste, W-A-S-T-E, you know, as in leftovers. And Zhurong, of the title, is what appears to be some sort of an AI system that is in charge of everything on the planet and continues to run the place exactly as it did before when there were people there. And in that regard, it reminded me of Ray Bradbury's classic story, There Will Come Soft Rains, which is where a robot house continues to function long after all the people are dead. Other than that one point, it doesn't have any resemblance to the Bradbury story. Mm. Later on, Zhurong begins transforming Olympus Mons into what I can only describe as a massive electronic circuit. And then Gong Gong, an early Mars rover, is dug up and revived. And they kind of work together, and then they have a falling out. I don't really want to go into any more detail on it. I think you have to read it, because it's got some very unusual turns in the story. What did you think of this one, Colin?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. I particularly enjoyed the author's notes at the end, talking about the origin of the names Zhurong and Gong Gong.
Yeah.
Because again, this is a science fiction by a Chinese author. It uses cultural references and tropes that people here in the States in general won't be familiar with.
Yeah.
So Zhurong is the god of fire, and mm-hmm. Gong Gong is the god of water. So when they begin fighting, all their fighting terms are couched in those terms. There's fireballs and floods and other kinds of things going on, and there's steam where they get together and meet.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting discussion about the humanity of potential artificial intelligences.
And it struck me that, I don't know if this was an intent of the story or of the author, but it struck me that what you call things will have an influence on how you interpret the future behavior of those things. So when Gong Gong was originally named, presumably they were just naming a Mars rover. They weren't imagining that it would eventually take on kind of godlike powers, which is more or less what the story says happens by the end.
Mm-hmm.
But it made me think, if they'd called it something else, if they hadn't given it the name of a god, would its behavior have been interpreted as being godlike? You know, it's as if the mythology allows another generation of mythology to persist. There were various shifts of perspective, because we begin really focused very much on Zhurong, and by the end of the story we've got a very detached view, because the indigenous life form on Mars, which I think is referred to as a fungus, by the end of the story has become sentient and is mythologizing for itself. So the shifts of perspective there are quite colossal. You know, we're not just going from the point of view of one character to another, we're going from one species or civilization to another.
Yeah, I like how the mythology of the destruction of Olympus Mons became part of, the actual destruction of Olympus Mons became part of their mythology, that the gods of fire and water did battle over it and destroyed it.
Yeah, it's quite a fantastic piece, really. I mean, fantastic in both senses of the word, in being a fantasy-like piece, but also being a very imaginative and creative piece.
I also liked the parts where Zhurong is wondering about whether it's alive or not.
Oh, yes.
And there's a quote I wanted to read that comes at the end of the story. And I have to say that the author has chosen to use alternate pronouns to describe the artificial intelligences, to keep them, you know, separate from, you know, human pronouns, just so there's no question about what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So, in air last moments, Zhurong figured out the answer. Once E experienced death, then E would know that E had once been alive.
Yeah. Difficult to read, isn't it? Because you kind of want to translate those into more familiar pronouns for us. But yeah. I thought it was quite a clever thing to have, especially for a translator to have done, because there is a translator's note that says that this is an attempt to reflect the pronoun choices made in Chinese. So yeah, these are artificial pronouns, but it's supposed to have the same effect for us as a reader of English as it would for the original Chinese reader. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
The only note I've got in terms of dialogue is the opposing attitudes of Zhurong and Gong Gong when they discover this Martian fungus for the first time, discovering that there is sort of native life on Mars. Zhurong's attitude is, we have to help them. But Gong Gong's attitude is, we have to get rid of them immediately. Oh. And that's what puts the two of them in conflict.
Yeah, I think it reflects, you know, their base natures. You know, Zhurong was looking for another life, another artificial intelligence, to see whether it was alive.
Yes.
And Gong Gong had been, you know, conscious and aware, and having stumbled on the mycelial network by accident and being overwhelmed by the data, shut itself down to protect itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, its immediate opinion of the fungus was negative.
Yes. It seems that we quite like that one then.
Yeah, I think it was good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, very unusual. The next one I've got on my list is DIY by John Wiswell.
Now, we've read John Wiswell before.
Yes.
So that was Open House on Haunted Hill, I think was the title of his story.
Mm-hmm.
Which won the 2021 Hugo short story and the 22 Locus Awards.
Yep.
Actually, the author won those awards. I think the short story did win the 2021 Hugo. This is much more of a fantasy story than science, you know, classic science fiction.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly fine, because the Hugos will handle all of those. And what we have are characters that live in a magical world that is definitely experiencing massive levels of climate change, to where there's like an international drought.
Yeah.
And the Ozymandias Academy is in charge of all magic, and they're working as hard as they can to try and providing the world with water. But what is actually happening is that it's going to the right people for the right money, and most other people don't have enough water to turn on the taps in their houses. The main characters are Noah, who has cherub lung, which is a disease, and Manny, also known as MX Potluck. Mm-hmm. And they find one another because Noah is determined to try and solve this water crisis by himself. And he wanted to do it through magic, and so he applied to the Ozymandias Academy, but he didn't have enough money to go. So he is now going to take, literally, the DIY route.
Yeah.
Their plan is to make magical desalination. And what they end up doing is several times is they will post questions onto online forums that they know cannot be answered. But immediately, you know, dozens and dozens of people will show up to refute why they can't do the thing, why they can do the thing that they don't think they can do. And there's comments made about crackpots on the internet, which is totally appropriate.
Yeah.
The quote from there that I want to pull is, "There is no educational research in the cosmos greater than a nerd who thinks you are wrong." And so it's the story of, you know, them trying to find a way to magically desalinate water. And when they find it, what happens?
There's a kind of an evil opponent that they have to overcome, isn't there? Who I only wrote down the first name, which is Vamon. I can't remember the full name of the character. So it is a kind of good versus evil story. It's kind of, well, it makes you think of Harry Potter, I think, straight away, as soon as you hear about a magic academy. And as usual with a John Wiswell story, there is a seriousness to it. Obviously, the themes of the story, the messages that the story tries to get across are very serious. But nevertheless, it's the story feels humorous and light in appropriate places, shall we say.
Yeah, I like his prose. I pulled another quote. It says, "I felt like a bunch of steaks someone stapled together that the doctors had mistaken for a survivor."
The next one I've got is On the Razor's Edge by Jang Bo.
But when you read the author's notes, they noted that they had used an artificial intelligence to translate it. And the original title is Life Hanging by a Thread.
Right, yes. Which turns out to be more appropriate, doesn't it, to the actual events of the story?
Yeah.
If I can sum it up as simply as I can, essentially, you've got the Chinese space station in orbit and you've got the International Space Station, and micrometeors start damaging the Chinese space station. And that's where we are, you know, when we're reading the story. We're with the Chinese on the Chinese space station. They get some damage, but they learn from mission control that the Americans on the ISS have suffered even more damage, and they're trapped on the ISS. They've got no means of getting out, and they can't stay there because it's too dangerous. So the Chinese are asked if they can mount some kind of rescue. Now, of course, that's almost impossible because these things are in totally different orbits. But strangely, somebody figures out, if we had a long enough rope, we could actually sort of throw the rope to them, sort of like throwing a lifeline, at the right moment in time when the two orbits, I think it says the orbits are going to intersect, but whether it literally meant that or whether it just meant they were coming close together, I don't know. Anyway, basically putting a lifeline, a very fine thread between the two space stations. And fortunately, the Chinese station has thousands of meters of nanotube thread on board because they've been doing some space ladder experiments.
Yes.
Highly convenient, but actually I found that technically a very interesting story. In a way, I didn't believe it for a moment because I thought, nah, you couldn't do that. It's not possible. But the story allowed me to believe that it would be possible. And having convinced me of that, it then gets on with the storytelling and there is quite some jeopardy involved. And the finest moment of the story for me was when the three Americans say that only two of them need to be rescued because one of them has basically volunteered to stay on board the ISS and apply a critical braking maneuver, which means that that astronaut basically will not survive. And then, after that, another one of the astronauts, the American astronauts, sacrifices himself to save the others, and he ends up falling back to Earth. Mm-hmm. So, and I suppose the moral of the story is that all space travellers are as one. Nationality doesn't matter. If you're a space traveller, you help your fellow space travellers, which I thought is, in a way, a traditional position to take. But also it strikes me as a bit old-fashioned, because space is very divided up along national lines these days, with, you know, different countries having their different programs rather than all teaming together to work on a single space program. But I found this one really engaging, even though it seemed like the kind of science fiction story you'd read back in the 1940s. You know, it's hard science fiction. It's the nuts and bolts of how are we going to do this. But I found it really engaging.
I did too. It struck me about The Martian. Struck me like The Martian in that way.
Yeah. Or the Arthur C. Clarke novel about the space elevator, Fountains of Paradise, that will be. That ends, well, it doesn't end. The final section of the book is about a rescue from the failed space elevator. So it's that kind of, here's this unlikely premise that we've explained to you over, in Clark's case, over hundreds of pages, and now we're going to throw a spanner in the works and the whole thing will unravel, but we will find a solution. And it's the same kind of feel that this story had, so I quite liked it, even though I think this one was probably the wonkiest translation.
So one of the things I've liked about this is how it continuously challenged my biases and perceptions of alternate forms of science fiction, because it was wonderful. It was good stuff. It was like going to a Chinese restaurant or a Japanese restaurant and experiencing this incredible meal when all you'd ever had was teriyaki chicken and rice.
Yeah.
So this author has been publishing since 2008.
Oh, right.
But the language reminds me horribly of badly translated Japanese and Chinese science fiction and horror films.
Yes.
I would love to see a human-made translation of this, because I think it would be better than what's here. Because I really enjoyed this story a lot.
Yeah.
The story has my kind of jive to it. You know, hard science fiction. It's a rescue piece, kind of like The Martian. But I was continuously taken out by the language and the way things were presented. It's like, is that really? It's awfully stilted. It's awfully artificial. It's awfully formal. It's just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And to be fair to the author, there is a little note about the translation which says that it was translated by AI because the author didn't have time. There was a deadline and they didn't have time to prepare a sort of a proper translation. Given that it is an AI translation, I'm amazed how readable it is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree with you. I'd love to see a really good translation by a sympathetic translator who is not just a linguist, but somebody who is actually a creative writer and knows how to choose the exact right word.
There's got to be something in here about, you know, resource availability as well.
Yeah.
Since the Hugos tend to be in English, we don't need translations. Mm-hmm. But for pieces written in other languages, there's this additional hurdle that people have to overcome. Yeah. The cost of hiring a translator, which is probably not small and is probably worth more than the people may have been paid for writing the short story in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good point. Should we move on to the next one?
Yes.
The next one is Rabbit Test by Samantha Mills. Would you like to try and summarize this one, Colin?
Yeah, I'm going to pull an author quote to do that, because she does the best job that I have seen of doing that. In which I get real fussed about the past, present, and future of abortion rights in America. This story is going to jump you through 1,000 years of bodily autonomy and ability and illegality of abortion that women have been allowed to have. Yeah. And it was kind of sponsored by a Supreme Court ruling from a year and a half ago, where one of the constitutional amendments had been considered to give the right of abortion to women. And the most recent Supreme Court said, no, that interpretation is wrong, based on some very bad historical understandings of abortion that they brought forth for some reason, mm-hmm. and took that away.
Yeah. So this is the Roe versus Wade ruling originally, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, and then it was overturned after being in place for many years. If I could just give a non-American perspective on that, I would point out that although obviously Roe versus Wade has no sway whatsoever on British law, and our abortion laws are still way more generous than the, frankly, the confusing mess that we see in the US, we are aware, I say this as an outsider, here in Europe, we're aware of Roe versus Wade, we're aware of its overturning, we're aware of how absolutely contentious this is in American politics, but it's probably a bit like Brexit looks to an outsider. It looks, Brexit looks an absolute mess from the outside, and it is.
It looks the same way from the inside too, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. But that's the thing about Roe versus Wade. If it were an insignificant court ruling, we would never have heard about it over here. But because it is something that has such a huge impact in a country that we used to think of as being one of the, you know, more progressive and liberal regimes in the world, it was shocking when that was overturned, even though it doesn't directly affect us over here. So anyway, I just wanted to put the outsider's view of how this comes across.
Yeah. So the author is going to jump us through, like I said, over 1,000 years of bodily autonomy for women. Mm-hmm. And there's a framing narrative, and it's about a young woman, I believe she's going to be just become 18, who found a way to escape her parents' control for a little bit and had a tete-a-tete, so to say, with mm-hmm. a young man, and became pregnant. Mm. That in itself isn't remarkable, nor is it science fiction. But in this science fictional world, women's bodily autonomy has decreased so much that this young woman had forcefully put in her body a medical implant, which monitors her birth and pregnancy status.
Yeah.
And so she doesn't want her parents to know that she became pregnant. They hack her implant. They're looking for a way to have an abortion quickly and safely, and her parents catch her doing that. It turns out her mom lobbied for the very implant, which her, you know, she forcefully put into her daughter. So there's this history going on there. And then there's the stories of women in the past and what they had to do and go through to see if they were pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my wife is a certified nurse midwife, and I prided myself on my knowledge of some of these things, but the things I learned from the story were incredible.
Yeah.
And then there's the future of what happens to this young girl and her daughter, which she is forced to bring to term, and what happens in the future to them.
Yeah. So it is really a dystopian story, isn't it? But I did feel that there was a glimmer of hope towards the end, as we move into the next generation, if you like. We move on to the daughter. Mm-hmm. So there's a little glimmer of hope. But as you say, this overwhelming impression that's given of how women have had the ability to control their own bodies completely quashed in the past and into the present as well. And the author does it by not taking us through a chronological history of how this happened, but by almost randomly dipping back into different points in the past. Just to give you a little vignette of, well, here's this issue that this woman in, 1276 might have faced, and then back in 1811, here's another woman with a different issue, but it's all tied to this same thing. I thought it was a really, really powerful way of approaching the story. And I'm somebody who doesn't usually like stories that leap backwards and forwards in time. I get very annoyed by flashbacks and flash forwards and all that kind of thing. But this story did it incredibly well, and I was very impressed.
The story is extremely popular. Yeah. It won the 2023 Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award. It won the Nebula. It won the Locus. It's on the BSFA long list. It's Hugo nominated.
So do we think we have a winner?
I think this one may be the one that wins due to its immense popularity. It reminds me of Where Oak and Hearts Do Gather. Last year.
Oh, yes. In the sense of its popularity, the sort of the groundswell carrying it.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, this is, again, it's a Chinese-located Hugo's, and it'll be a big question whether or not that popularity transcends cultures or not.
That was the thing that occurred to me, because we've seen from the stories on the ballot that the fact that the convention is in China has had a huge impact on the content of the ballot. Will that be reflected in the voting as well? Obviously it will, to a degree, but whether it will reflect it enough. I was prompted, after reading this story, to go and look up what the situation is with abortion in China and the history of that. And, of course, culturally, it's a very different thing to them. In the People's Republic of China, for a long time, they had this policy of limiting how many children families could have. Now, although that's been abolished, they used to have a one-child policy, and then it was relaxed, and I think it's now been taken away completely. But obviously, in that kind of environment where family planning is critical to the sort of the government's, I don't know what they call them, five-year plans or whatever, abortion has to be part of that mix, whether people like it or not, you know. And yes, abortion is widely available in China. It doesn't appear to be a taboo topic or anything like that. So it does make me wonder, the average Chinese reader, will they understand the depth of the issue that this story reflects as a story from the US? Now, as a European, I do recognise that, because we've been exposed to Roe versus Wade and its overturning and the controversy surrounding it. But I don't know if Chinese people will know about that.
Yeah. Oh, and just to tie a bow on something, you mentioned Brexit.
Yeah.
So here inside the state of Oregon, the Western Valley is highly liberal, mostly Democrats.
Okay.
Most of the rest of the state is highly conservative.
Right.
Mostly Republicans.
Yeah.
And you can almost look at a rainfall map and compare it to a political map, and you'll see this exact match in the Great Divide.
Wow.
There are a number of counties in Oregon, the political subdivisions of a state, that want to leave and join the first state to the east, Idaho, which as a state in general is highly conservative. So they call it the Greater Idaho Movement.
Wow.
And it has the same kind of ramifications of a Brexit. So
that's amazing. I have no idea.
Yeah, who knows how far it's going to go, but
yeah,
science fiction worlds that we live in.
Yeah. So, Rabbit's S by Samantha Mills. We said quite a bit about that, but I think it deserves it. The next one is Resurrection by Ren Qing. And I've got very few notes on this one because I didn't really... I was going to say I didn't get it. I got it, but I didn't really enjoy it very much. My first note is, a corpse is resurrected. And then my second note is, various reasons for people to oppose it.
Oh, yeah.
and it is very good at giving lots of different objections to a thing. Well done to the author for that, but I didn't really enjoy this story very much. Have you got anything positive that you can say, Colin, to lift the tone?
Yeah, well, speaking of lifting the tone, I think this is supposed to be comedic.
Yes.
So, there's a war, and a mother loses her son, her only son, and because of the circumstances of his death, they're going to give her what they term a resurrected corpse, so she has some time to say goodbye to her son.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wondering whether this is really her son or not, because there's all these warnings about, well, you know, his chip was damaged, so his consciousness may not have fully transferred, and so on and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
and she goes, how will I know it's really my son? And then the corpse says, I'm hungry. And the mother turns to him and say, well, what would you like to eat? And he says, stir-fried pork with garlic shoots. And she goes, it's him! And so I actually read this twice, because the first time I read it, I had the same kind of takeaways that I think you did. It's like, wow, so this is about alienation and bias and prejudice and fear. And, you know, the science fiction aspects are the war and the resurrection and the fact that these resurrected corpses are being designed to replace humans in actual war and to perpetuate our consciousness, because you'll drop your consciousness into a corpse for a while and then you'll hop into another one so you can do these very dangerous things safely and you never need to die.
Yeah. And I have to say, for all of my boredom with the story, it did lay out its premise very well. And I think this is true of all of the Chinese stories on this ballot. Every one of them has a very succinct premise and then a kind of a what if. So it is doing the very classic thing that science fiction, good science fiction, has always done. And I did appreciate that about the story, but I didn't really get much from it. And maybe I should have gone back for another read, because I may well have missed something.
There's a technician that's a part of the story, and it's a person in a wheelchair because they were in an accident on the way to the village where the woman and her corpse are.
Yeah.
And his lines and the things he says, I found them hilarious. You know, like, don't patronize me. I'm a man with weapons. And then the horrible ending, which is, you know, what do you think he was born for?
Yeah.
And that always makes me think of the Star Trek The Next Generation episode where Data gets to try and defend his humanity.
Is that A Measure of a Man, where he's in a courtroom? Yeah.
You will defend Mr. Data, or I will declare that he is a toaster oven and the property of Starfleet.
Yes. Okay, so it does sound like the story is doing some good things, and I probably haven't done it justice by only reading it once, so my apologies to the author. And shall we go on to the next one?
Yeah.
The White Cliff by Lu Ban. I've got, a man wakes up in a place by the sea with an endless white cliff, and he's visited by one of his students, who it seems is also his daughter. And they talk about her father, which I gather is him. And the reason I sound a bit vague is because the story is sort of drifting in and out of reality, even as it's being told. At least that's my impression of it. It seems that they're both part of a project, which I think is called DTC or something like that.
Yes.
And the project enables people, as they approach the end of life, to have some hope of continuance, so that they don't just feel that their life has ended suddenly and has been of no consequence. And through this project, their body and brain is used to sustain a kind of a programmed illusion. And by this point, once we've learnt this, it becomes clear that the White Cliff, the beach, and probably most of what's been going on in the story is part of this programmed illusion. Your body has to be physically capable of sustaining the illusion, and there may be limitations. And at the end of the story, as you might expect, if I read it correctly anyway, the father dies. This is another one which I thought was marred by some poor translation, and I think this one is probably the one with the most sort of typographical issues as well. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, I found it quite powerful, even as I was reading it, some of the things that I thought, this is quite dreamlike, but at the same time I was thinking, maybe that's a bad translation. Maybe it's not meant to be dreamlike. Maybe it's meant to be crystal clear. And this is the disadvantage we have whenever we read translated fiction. We can't be sure of what the original intention was. All we've got is the text. And what we have, I think, is a very dreamlike story. And although it reads quite like a fantasy, It does have this very firm science fictional premise. It is a kind of a scientific premise. And I did like that about it. And I did like this a lot more than I liked Resurrection. What did you think?
Oh, I thought it was just a heartbreaker of a piece.
Mm.
So, you know, when I read, and I've mentioned this in the past, I project myself into the story.
Yeah.
And so here I'm the professor, and one of my students comes by, and the student is talking about what her father is struggling and going through, and she's very upset about this. And then there's the revelation that he is the father, mm-hmm. and that he is in this experiment and he is dying. And the daughter comes to him to, you know, see what's going on in their experiment to see if this will help other people in end-of-life situations. And then Then there's a revelation that when the sun sets, it will coincide with the end of his life. And they have given him the right to make that decision by his actions in this dreamlike simulation. And
that's reassuring to me that you found it powerful as well, because I was wondering if I was sort of projecting into this story things that weren't there, because I also found it a very sort of profound and moving piece, even while I was suspicious of the quality of the translation. But I think anybody who has lost a close family member, and particularly anyone who has lost somebody through dementia, would find this, I think, a very powerful and even an upsetting story.
Yeah. Let me say two things. Yeah. One, I don't know if the translation is bad, because the prose is great. Mm-hmm. And it conveys that dreamlike state that I think that the science fiction project would create inside of a person's head.
Yeah.
Pretty well. But I was like, for some of the other ebooks, I was continuously pulled out of the story by trying to read an English word spelled wrong, or figuring out why this punctuation is an image instead of a question mark. And
oh, yeah.
I'm a little obsessive about that, to the point where I've taken ebooks that I've bought and I've hand edited them to fix typos. And I almost did that with some of these, but I didn't. I kept my cool.
Yeah. So I think we've gone through all the stories now.
All six, yes.
Yeah. Shall we do overall personal favorites?
Yeah.
I think my favorite is Rabbit Test by Samantha Mills. It does have a science fictional premise, which is drawn from the headlines, so it's very much of now, so it's powerfully resonant in today's world, but it also proves that this is not an issue of now. This is an issue of always and forever, and I think that's a very great service for a science fiction story to be carrying out, I think. Plus, it's warning us about the future in this kind of, if watch out, because this is where we're heading. So I think it's doing so many things that good science fiction can do. And it's a very readable piece, very affecting. So that's my personal favorite.
I'm split. Mm. Life Hanging by a Thread, On the Razor's Edge, I think was my favorite science fiction piece.
Mm-hmm.
Just because that's my kind of story. I would read stuff like that every day if I could.
Yeah, yeah.
The piece that moved me the most, though, was The White Cliff.
Yeah.
I would not read that frequently, but if I did, I would enjoy it. And I would only read it at particular times because of the emotions it brings forth from me. So
absolutely, yeah. And then in terms of what do we think is going to win, I mean, I find it really... Well, I always find it difficult to predict. But with this ballot, I find it impossible to predict. I suspect that Rabbit Test will be hugely popular, but I also suspect that there will be a substantial fraction of science fiction fandom that will be very opposed to Rabbit Test. Now, that I mean, obviously they can't cast a negative vote, but they can vote for something else strategically, you know.
Right.
So, and then the fact that the convention is in China, and a substantial number of people nominating and voting are from China, makes it, I think, impossible to call.
I don't know. We'll find out in a couple of days.
We will. But what we can say is that any minute now, Phil from the future will drop in just here and tell us which one won the vote. This is Phil from the future dropping in to say that the Short Story Hugo Award went to Rabbit Test by Samantha Mills. So this is Phil from the future saying thank you for listening to this update, and now back to the normal podcast. Thank you, Phil from the future. That's very interesting, isn't it, Colin, to know which story won in the end?
Yeah, I wish that Phil from the future had told us if Seth won the fan cast category or not.
maybe Phil from the future can do that. We don't know.
He is a sneaky guy.
He is.
I have a quiz for you today.
Hooray.
So there's good news and there's bad news.
Oh.
The good news is I think you're going to enjoy the quiz.
Hooray.
The bad news is it's one of the quizzes I have created for myself. I did not find this on the web, so it has not been audited or checked by other people.
Okay.
So we'll find out if my hopes follow through.
Sure.
So my quiz today is not a literal trivia quiz. I'm going to feed you bits of information about a person and have you try and guess who this person is.
Okay.
I have arranged these hints roughly in chronological order, but not absolutely.
Okay.
And there are 7 hints I'm going to give you. I know this person and I've studied their life very carefully recently, so I can give you some more if you need it. But I think you're going to get this by like 4 or 5. So if you're confused for a while, don't be frustrated.
Okay.
First hint. This person was published in the British Science Fiction Association's Matrix. Now, that's awfully generic. There's been a lot of people published in the Matrix.
Yeah.
Let me give you another one.
Okay.
This person has hosted a science fiction website since at least 2005.
This is me, isn't it?
This is you. Oh, my gosh. I'm too transparent. How did you know so fast?
Well, I mean, when you mentioned Matrix, I was in Matrix quite a lot back in the day. So when you say the person was in Matrix, my first thought is, well, it could be me. I thought, no, it can't be me.
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time in the ISFDB and CSFDB looking up these authors, and I thought, I wonder if Phil is in here, because I know you've done some scholarly and some non-scholarly work. I hadn't realized you have been involved in science fiction in a publication level since 1981.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you wrote an essay, Science Fiction on BBC Radio in 1981. So you've been around the block.
Yeah, I have. That was, I can't remember the precise sequence of events, but I, very soon after joining the British Science Fiction Association, I began to realise that most of the content of their publications were written by the members. And, you know, and you think, well, I could do that if only I had something that I knew about that I could write about. And BBC Radio Science Fiction was a thing that I was very much into at that time. So I thought, I'll write an article and send it in. Didn't think they would publish it, but they did. And that's what got me started. And I think for a while I thought, this means anyone can write and we're probably, or most of us are probably rubbish at it. And it was only after a few years of doing it and learning that other people had submitted things and they'd been rejected, but I'd never had anything rejected. I mean, I have now, but up to a certain point, you keep submitting things and they get accepted and people around you are getting rejected and you think, oh, actually, maybe I can write then. Maybe this is a skill that I have. And shall I let you into a little secret?
Sure.
Earlier today, I looked myself up on ISFDB, and I can't remember what prompted me to do it. And I was shocked and annoyed to see how many different names they had for me, some of which are misspellings of my name, because editors misspelled my name when they put my articles in their publications. And this is a burden that you have to carry. I mean, I could correct the errors and say, no, that wasn't that spelling of the name, that was me, so it should be spelled like this. But they are correct when they say the incorrect spelling, because that reflects what was actually published.
So if you've looked at that, is there anything that you saw that was immediately missing?
Well, yes, there's quite a few things that I've published in the last 10 or 15 years that aren't listed there, because they're not in fannish publications and they're not in stuff that you would find in the average bookshop. They're in academic books and academic journals. But you've got to tell me, what are these other clues, Colin?
Okay, so clue number 3 is this person is an editor.
Okay.
This person is a consultant.
Yes, yeah, that is true, yes.
Yeah, you are the senior advisor. And I always get the two organizations mixed up. So what is your official title? Senior consultant to the...
Senior consultant to the Ray Bradbury Center.
This person has been on multiple podcasts.
True.
This person is an actor.
Oh my god, not really, but
Yeah, you've done some voiceover and that I know of recently.
Yeah.
And I know you've done a few other things. And then the last clue was this person recently became the editor of a scholarly journal.
Yeah, it's definitely me.
That is you.
I'm now sitting here pondering how I can exact my revenge. I've got to come up with a Colin Cusky quiz without there being any clue as to what I'm up to.
I'm much less published than you are, so that might be difficult. Although I was on radio once.
Just the once?
Yeah, in 1988, I did a rap advertisement for an anti-drug commercial for the city of Cottage Grove.
Wow. Is that online anywhere?
I dearly hope not. It might be on a piece of tape someplace, somewhere. I don't know.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for that quiz. How many points do I get for getting it in two?
Oh, my goodness. That's well, if you'd gotten it in one, that would have been amazing. But with two, I think we'd have to go 9.5 out of 10.
Shall we move on to past, present, and future?
Let's.
Here's a past item. I recently watched War of the Worlds, the George Powell film from the 1950s, in 4K on my... Because I've got a big telly now, you see. I bought a 4K telly. I've had a 4K Blu-ray player for a couple of years, but only had a high-definition television. So I finally upgraded my telly so I could watch all of my 4K films in all their 4K glory. So I watch War of the Worlds in 4K. And it looks beautiful. It looks really good. I did detect that they'd done something with the audio because they put in some stereo sound effects, which most of the film is very definitely a mono audio track. But when there are explosions and stuff, they sort of suddenly go stereo. So they've tampered with the sound. But other than that, it's a really good capture of the movie. I've never really paid any attention to the acting in The War of the Worlds, but I noticed this time that Gene Barry, the star of it, is very subdued. It kind of makes his performance strangely feel more modern than it should, because it kind of feels like a very laid-back 21st century performance. Very strange. One thing I didn't like about War of the Worlds, and I've never liked about the film, is the ending, because it seems to imply, I don't know if you remember the film, Colin, but it seems to imply that if you gather in a church and pray, the Martians will all die. I mean, it doesn't literally say that, but the conjunction of events at the end of the film are such that you could legitimately interpret that the Martians died because they prayed for the Martians to die.
God struck them down with a plague.
Yeah, which I think is terrible. It's a terrible ending and sacrilegious in terms of what it does to H.G. Wells. But I'm amazed how good the film looks in 4K HDR. Have you got any past items?
Yes, and I actually thought you were going to steal this one.
Oh.
This year is the 70th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, it is, yes.
And I think it's appropriate that we talked a little bit about abortion, because also here in the United States, we are dealing with episodes of book banning.
Yeah.
So I would encourage you, if you haven't read Fahrenheit 451, go and do it and learn some lessons.
Fahrenheit 451 should be horribly old-fashioned and irrelevant at this point, but it is more pertinent now than it's been for a long, long time. I've got another past one, but this is very much ad hoc because I just happened to watch this before recording today. I watched the film Runaway from 1984, 85. It's a Michael Crichton film.
With Tom Selleck.
Yeah.
And Kirstie Alley.
Yes.
And Gene Simmons.
Yes.
Oh, that's a great movie.
Now, I haven't seen this since 1985. I remember watching it on home video back in the 80s, and I literally haven't seen it since. And I got a Blu-ray of it, and I thought, I'll watch this. I was half expecting it to not be very good, and to be honest, it's not great. It's very well structured as a piece of screenwriting by Crichton. It's a very well structured piece with lots of foreshadowing So it's kind of textbook in that sense. But what amazed me is what Crichton did with that film. This is one of the last films that he directed, because his directing career was not going terribly well, so he kind of gave up film directing and just went back into writing novels. And then he had a huge hit with Jurassic Park, of course, mm-hmm. And never looked back from there. But what he does in this film is he doesn't tell you when it is or where it is. It's just set in what appears to be an American city. It appears to be the present day. But everybody's got a robot in their house, you know, a little household robot that sweeps up for them, keeps an eye on the kids and all that kind of thing. And it's just very matter of fact. But then these robots start going crazy and the police have a runaway squad because so many of these robots are behaving in a very antisocial manner that the police have to have a special squad to go out and hunt them down and capture them. So it's a weird little premise. But what I love about it is that this was made before the internet and before mobile phones, and it is clearly showing what it thinks the immediate future is going to be. And it's got drones in it, little handheld drone cameras, which is beautiful prediction of what would really come to be in our world. And yet, as I say, it doesn't know anything about the internet or mobile phones. Actually, mobile phones are mentioned, but we don't see any in the film. And of course, all the TV screens, all the monitors are CRTs, you know, so it's very much of 1984. But it's as you said, it's a great film, but a very weird thing to watch nowadays.
Yeah, I think most people don't realize that it's really the prequel to Robopocalypse. not really, but it's...
That's one way of looking at it, yeah. Yeah. Any more past items?
No.
Shall we do present then?
Yeah, I just finished the last novel from Brandon Sanderson's Four Secret Novels Kickstarter. And it's been a great year. I really enjoy Sanderson's writing. Mm-hmm. And I know you're not a big fan of fantasy. Mm-hmm. But I think this is the book that might bridge the gap.
Okay.
So when most people think fantasy, they think of some guy in a wizard's robe and wizard hat waving a wand or quaffing a potion and invoking magic.
Yeah.
But what if magic was a more common thing? Uh-huh. For example, what if it was the way that energy could be stored stored or have energy pulled from this thing that you store energy in, so that you could make a steam engine using that magical item? Mm. Now all of a sudden, it's a little more like science fiction.
Yeah.
And what if the steam engine was used to levitate an entire city? And what if that city had to be levitated because it was on a planet whose direct sunlight was so strong, it melted the rock underneath it? And if those things were all true and related, that is this Brandon Sanderson book. And it sounds an awful lot like science fiction, except for the energy storage method.
Yeah. I tell you what you've done there. I think this is the first instance we have of something that has gone from being a future item to now being a present item. And in fact, if I ask you about this next month, it will be a past item. It'll be in your past. So we've actually witnessed something, because I remember you talking about this when it was originally just this sort of Kickstarter thing. But then you got the books in your own hands and now you've read them all. So from future to past in one easy move.
Yeah, 12 easy months. Although actually the Kickstarter has another, there are two more swag boxes to be released.
Ah, okay.
So in addition to the four novels, he put together this team to make swag boxes for the various properties and novels. Some of them were related to the books, some of them related to the properties. Mm. And every month you could get, a t-shirt, a sticker, a pencil, a cup, literal swag that you would get from a convention or a booth and have it delivered straight to your house.
I've got two present items, which I've grouped together because they're variations on a theme, really. A couple of very short films, which you can see on YouTube, or at least you can see them online. The first one is by someone called Erik Wernquist, and it's a very short film called One Revolution Per Minute. And basically, what he's done is he has created, this is all CGI, but he's created a rotating space station, like you see in the film 2001, A Space Odyssey. Mm-hmm. And he has he's built the model, the 3D model, and he's rotated it. And he gives you the experience of being inside this rotating space station. And it's really very fascinating to watch, because you're conscious that you're there in the space station. You are stationary, basically. And the whole universe is spinning about you. And the light of the sun is kind of moving in a big circle, you know, and therefore the shadows are all swinging about in different directions. It's an amazing little piece of filmmaking, and I imagine, having done a little bit of 3D modelling myself, I imagine that once you've built the model and given it the physics and then pressed the go button, I imagine it kind of does it all by itself, you know. But it's really beautiful to watch. And the other one is another short film. I don't have a note of the title of it, but somebody's made a very short sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey. And it's basically whatever happened to Frank Poole. If you remember the film, Frank Poole is the astronaut who gets killed by Hal and is last seen spinning off into space. So somebody's right. made a little film to show what happens next. And as you might imagine, well, there's two possibilities. One, he just flies off into space forever. The other is that he lands somewhere. And in this little film, he lands. We don't know exactly where. It's probably a moon of Jupiter or something.
Interesting.
But, it's beautifully done. It looks just like the real thing. It only takes a couple of minutes to watch it, but it's a really nice little thing. So I'll put links to those on our website.
Have you read the follow-ons to 2001?
I've read 2010 and I've read 2061, but I wouldn't go any further than 2061 because it was terrible.
Okay.
But 2010 is okay.
Yeah, 3001 has Frank Poole in it.
Oh, he comes back, does he? Oh, okay.
He's found by humans and thawed. And then, there's the usual thousand-year cultural lag, kind of an adaptation that goes on, and then there's kind of a resolution to the whole story.
Right, okay. I didn't know that. I did notice on YouTube where this little film is, it does say something like, this ignores the events of 2010, 2061, and 3001. It is literally a sequel to the film and nothing else. Any more present items?
No.
Okay, moving on to the future then. Here's a weird sort of future one. I've described this as how communicating with whales might help us anticipate communicating with aliens. And this is an article on the SETI website, SETI.org. And there are scientists who are trying to communicate with whales and trying to figure out if that is going, it is like what it's going to be like talking to aliens. I mean, I've always said this, that if we want to know whether we can talk to aliens, let's see if we can talk to dogs or whales first. Because if we can't talk to a thing that comes from the same planet as us, we've got no hope of ever talking to anything from anywhere else. So people are taking that seriously and doing science on it. So quite impressed with that.
Huh. You know, I talk about Mary Robinette Cole quite a bit. I enjoy her writing a lot, and so I read her books. And I follow her on social media, and one of the things that she has been doing for the past few years is she has bought into this idea of pet communication. Mm. And so if you go to her YouTube channel or you follow her on Blue Sky, she'll post videos of her animals and her interacting using this board for communication. And there's a lot of skepticism about what's really happening. Have the animals been trained to say things to get what they want, or do they have actual intelligence and feelings they're expressing? I don't know myself one way or the other, but it's interesting to look at that. I mentioned my future thing, although it's going to be a past thing by the time this comes out. The 2023 Hugo's live cast is at 1900 hours Chinese time, which is 4 a.m. in the morning, Saturday in the Pacific here. So to find out, you know, who wrote the best short story and to see whether or not Seth won the fan cast and many other things. Will Mr. Scalzi I think he's nominated again. Will he take another award home? Yeah.
And of course, to our listeners, all of this, as you say, is very much in the past by the time they hear this episode. I have been following Robert J. Sawyer's post on Facebook because he's the guest of honour at the World Science Fiction Convention. He's been posting a lot, and he says that this convention is the best one he's ever been to, the best World Science Fiction Convention, and he's been to quite a few, so he should know. To what extent his view of it is shaped by the fact that he is a guest of honour and is being treated, therefore, in a special way, I don't know. So it'd be interesting to know from sort of ordinary people, in quotes, who are attending it, to see if they think that it's the best convention ever. But it certainly looks very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, they built a convention center to host this, if I remember correctly.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and so the advertising and the government and business sponsorship and the excitement of people, I mean, they're not only selling Hugo memberships, but you can just buy a ticket to attend this as a casual person. So that was a little more controversial as well, because that hasn't happened in the past, and I think it's rubbing some people the wrong way. But I'll be very interested to see what people say during and after the convention.
Yeah,
I would like to see Worldcon be a little more worldly, though. I think that would be good for the science fiction community at large.
Yeah.
And to expose people to more of these stories, authors and cultures and writers, I think is a very good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree with that. The only caveat is, am I even entitled to that opinion as somebody who's never been to one? What business is it of me to have an opinion on that matter? Anyway.
Well, we'll just have to attend one and make sure that your opinion is... legalized?
Yeah, formalized? That's it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see if that happens next year.
Okay, I've got one final future thing, which is what our next episode will be about. Next episode will be out in December, so we'll be doing our third annual time travel episode, where we go back in time and review an old science fiction magazine to see how times have changed. And this year, we're setting a course for the dead centre of the new wave in science fiction by reviewing an issue of New Worlds, which was the influential British science fiction magazine of the late 60s and early 70s. So join us if you dare. Are you still up for that, Colin?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good. We'll let you know ahead of time what the exact magazine issue is. So if you want to read ahead and then listen to our opinions, you'll be able to do that. Are we done, Colin?
I'm wrapped up. I'm ready.
Wrapped up and ready to go. Thanks for listening, folks. We're Phil Nichols and Colin Cuskey, and our theme tune is from Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. Check out the show notes on our website at 101sf.blogspot.com. And please give us a glowing 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your pods. And we'll see you next time.